Welcome everyone to another episode of the Mind Sculptors Podcast. I am your host, Callahan. This week, I sit down with the Croc Father, Ken Bauman, and a mob of squirrels, James, to discuss the four key patterns of winning a game of CEDH. As you can see from the thumbnail and title, we did fall down a little bit of a rabbit hole talking about how sports relates to this topic, but it was a really fun conversation, and I'm really excited to bring it all to you today. But before we get into that, let's take a moment to talk about today's sponsor, Dragon Shield. Dragon Shield sleeves are the only sleeves that I trust on my cards, and I've been using them for nearly 7 years. Their Petrol Matte sleeves are my personal sleeves of choice, and if you use our Dragon Shield link to get yours, you will be supporting the Mind Sculptors channel. So go ahead, go into the description of the episode, click on our Dragon Shield affiliate link to get your sleeves today. Also, you could be an Agila card with our new merch we have available in our merch store. Head on over to themindsculptors.com/shop to pick up the new could be a Agila card t-shirt or hat today. With all that said, let's get into today's episode. I was thinking about this earlier when I was reading your thread that we're going to be talking about today. I was actually thinking, I was like, is Ken the new Cobblepot?
Oh, damn. I mean, I would be happy. I'd be honored to take those shoes from Cobble. And we're both sickos too. So that's like, you know, you got to pass it from autoimmune to autoimmune, you know? So I'm happy to do that for Cobble. That's great.
Big shoes the long to fill, threads. You play like wild. You both love Kirk.
That's true.
A lot of similarities there.
We're both very, very thin, like painfully thin. So
you two are some of the lankiest people I've ever met. And then, you know, there's me over here and I'm just like 6'1" and built like a linebacker. Yeah. So it's just,
There's some big, strong folks out there and I'm not one of them. I'm just a little lightning rod.
Also joining us is, we haven't got to introduce him as a sculpty boy yet. But our newest mind sculptor he's been on the channel before from the, what's the word that I'm looking for? The data collection project.
The metagame project.
Yeah, the metagame project. My brain just went. it's our boy James, otherwise known as Squirrel Mob. How you doing, James?
I'm doing well. Hello, everybody.
I am quite excited because I know I've talked about this a little bit, but I'm moving to Louisville here in a few months, and I am like, I'm not close to where James lives, but I am within like half a day's drive of where James and a lot of other people live.
Nice.
So it's only good. like 4-ish hours. So
Nothing. Four is easy peasy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the funny things because people, you know, where people like grew up in the country based on their perception of how long a trip is.
Yeah.
Because like, you talk to some people who grew up in like New England and like, you know, New York area, and it's like 4-hour trip. That's so long.
Yeah.
And then you talk to people who grew up in the Midwest and you're like, that's going to see grandma and grandpa. What are you talking about?
Exactly. In Texas, we would make 3-hour round trips of 6 hours total 4 times a week when I was working in Dallas. Jeez. So it was like, no big deal. You just live in a car. This is the era in which, you know, you had those big blocky TVs that had a VCR built in. And so we would put that like right by the shifter. And my mom and I would just watch movies while we drove. Very responsible, very safe. But man, we burned through so many Blockbuster titles.
Wow.
It was incredible.
That is, I can't say that I haven't done that when there's a football game on that I want to watch with my phone, but
exactly. You know. We're all naughty that way. We just, you know, this is great. It's a great way to watch movies.
It's actually specifically why I drive manual transmission car now. Prevent myself.
Oh, smart. Wow. Yeah. You got to keep your hand going. That's smart.
Mm-hmm. So that's What a way to flex that you know how to drive a manual car, James.
Yeah, that's cool. That's, no big deal.
Guys, it's no big deal. I know how to. Dude, if you put a manual in front of me, I would just sit there and stare at it. Like,
it's not,
just be like,
it's not bad. It's not bad. It's not bad. It really isn't.
But the issue is that, to quote John Mulaney, my brain has to, in my head, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But then it has to, like, transmit that information to my awkward legs and hands. And I don't know that that will always work the way that I want it to.
Do you brake with your left foot currently?
No.
Okay, so you drive with one foot anyway. So, like, that's half the battle there. Because there are people who, like, drive with 2 feet without driving a manual.
Oh, I used to date somebody who was like that, and I thought that was psycho, but...
it seems that's... Yeesh. I learned to drive manual on a friend's beater, old Honda Civic, for an hour. And then my next car, which I had spent 8 months building with my father, my next manual car was a Shelby Cobra replica that had 480 horsepower. And so that was quite a way to learn how to drive manual. In Los Angeles, second time I ever have driven a car that was a manual, it was in a car that was like a death trap, like a 1,300 pound just death trap. It was, that was trial by fire. It worked though. I learned fast. I had to. Also got pulled over a lot.
On a 97 Ford Contour with a shoddy, very, very, very short first gear.
Oh, okay.
So it was an exercise in a lot of trials and tribulations because first just never wanted to work.
You just got
to
skip over
you
it.
Just go you straight into second.
It's real hard to skip over first in a lot of situations. That's true. The problem.
Exactly.
My first car was an automatic 2000. I actually still have it. It's sitting in my parking lot and haven't driven it in 2 years. It's a 2005 Pontiac Montana SV6.
Ooh, oh yeah.
Which is, the sports trim of the Montana because in 2004, the good folks over at GM figured, you know what people want in their minivans? Is sport suspension in a V6 engine.
Absolutely. You gotta race that bad boy.
Unironically, I know somebody who bought a Cadillac SUV precisely because it had a V8 and every other SUV had a V6.
Yep. Whoa. Like, yeah, sure.
There was period of time in like the like early to mid thousands where they were just like the most mundane vehicle, we gotta give it like the sports treatment.
Yeah.
And we had that car and it was something.
It was a motor vehicle. One of the motor vehicles of all time.
The same engine as the Pontiac G6.
That's so funny.
It's hilarious. Same engine, same suspension. It was on like basically the same shell, except it was like a big long minivan.
It's the evolution of the Dustbuster minivan they used to have, the Transport or whatever, that looks like those little hand vacuums.
Oh, yeah.
I tore the rear suspension off one of those in a sinkhole.
Oh, wow. Damn.
Water main break. Yeah.
That's cool.
Would not recommend.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun evening.
That was 7 in the morning. Even worse.
God.
Well, you know, you can't, at least it wasn't a big, beautiful Buick Enclave.
That's true. We protect those here.
I was sitting here and I was like, we're talking about cars. My comment section is going to be on fire if I don't mention Buicks.
Yeah.
So anyway, why we're actually here today is we're not talking about cars as much as I would love to talk about just old shitty cars all day. Is we're here to talk about Commander and specifically competitive Commander. And Ken has some very interesting thoughts relating to some stuff about like the patterns of what games of CEDH look like. You did a thread about this on Twitter, a little over a week ago, exactly a week ago.
Oh boy,
and so I basically immediately messaged you in our group chat and was like, hey, or no, I didn't message you. I emailed you the proper way.
Yeah, that's true.
And was like, hey, Ken, let's expand on this. So take us through a little bit of it. You kind of start off going through like there's 23,000 cards are legal in Commander, and we only play about 2,000 of them. So
yep.
That's how you started off. And, you know, what is the whole kind of essence of what you're saying?
Yeah. So it's a good question. I initially wrote this as like a lecture type thing mm-hmm. for a CDH Discord that I'm in. And then I realized one day I just got bored with it. I was like, you know what? I'm going to make it much more concise and just get straight to the point and try to really articulate to people the core, the essential patterns that they will see over and over and over again when they play CDH. Because as I say in the thread, you know, I think that one of the reasons people really love CDH is not for its novelty necessarily, but it's for finding the beauty in repetition and the beauty in incrementally getting better at something and problem solving and really complex game states. And so the thread was my attempt to distill the four essential patterns that you will see in games of CDH and to explain what they are, what they imply about how to play better, and then also using those patterns to distill a few principles that we can use to understand CDH as a game more thoroughly and also to kind of be more honest about what it looks like on the ground.
Very interesting, because when this came out, there was a lot of people who were retweeting it who were like, this is exactly why I love CEDH. And then there were some people who were like, this is exactly why I don't want to play CEDH. Which I thought was very funny. So when we look at it, what are kind of the four essential patterns that you will see in a game of CEDH?
Yep. So I've got a handy mnemonic to remember them. It's dub tab or WTAB. Number one is win. Number two is win through. Number three is win after. And number four is win because. So W and then TAB, through, after, because. And these are the ways that games end. And because CDH is a format, or rather a metagame in which we are playing to win, trying to play as efficiently as possible, pursue wins as efficiently as possible with the decks that we have, how the game ends and how it leads to a position in which the winning player is able to, you know, pull it off, I think that that's pretty constantly on players' minds. And I really think that, you know, everybody starts sort of building up to the end of the game the second mulligan stop and the, you know, mm-hmm. the game begins. And so these four patterns are the ways that CDH games end. And I wanted to focus on the end of games because I think that those ends really can be used to explain after the fact most like smaller play patterns, most moments, mm-hmm. most considerations. You can kind of contextualize a lot of decisions that you make in a CDH game with the idea of, okay, what kind of game would this action lead to? Right? Mm-hmm. What kind of end state would this lend itself to being a part of? And I think that constantly thinking about that is actually a pretty good way to try to think ahead at least a few turns, which is, you know, kind of a mainstay of any difficult, complicated strategic game. You want to be thinking multiple steps ahead and planning out to the best of your ability. So yeah, those are the four patterns that I see, and I can walk through each one if that would be useful to the audience.
Yeah, what do these four look like?
So number one is easy, right? Win. That just is what happens when somebody goes for it. They go for it first. There's not much opposition, and they get there, right? Turbo decks do this a lot. You know, you just
Oracle Consult. Yep. Anybody got it?
Boom. Yeah. All right. Three mana. Game over. Cool. Shuffle up and, you know, go again. These are the games in which, you know, they end pretty early. And I think that you can do a couple different things to cultivate that play pattern, right? You could play turbo decks. Going first, being on the play helps, I think, a lot. And then also, if you have really disciplined or very lucky mulligans, that can also contribute a lot. A lot of hands just are nuts, and they're just there, and you've just got it all. You got everything you need. The second pattern that I've identified is just win through, right? That's mm-hmm. And we've seen this a lot. Somebody goes for it. Another opponent attempts to stop them. They're able to back up their win condition, you know, with counter magic or whatever, and they get there, right? So that is winning through opposing disruption, opposing interaction. And I think that winning through is generally more common than just winning, because CDH decks, right, are so highly interactive, usually have at least 20 pieces of disruptive, you know, effects. And so usually people will have something to expend in the first few turns to stop somebody else from going for it. But some decks do this better than others, right? Decks with access to white that play Grand Abolisher, Ranger Captain, et cetera, Silence. Those decks are really good at winning through interaction. I think Karkashima is a really good deck at winning through interaction because counterspells are two counterspells usually. And decks with efficient combos, I think, are also very good at this. Efficient A plus B combos that just win because you're able to conserve mana that you would otherwise spend assembling a win by protecting it, using a counterspell, using a silence or whatever, bouncing the stacks piece that you need to go off. The third pattern is, I think, in my mind, the best. This is what I encourage most people to go for. It's winning after. And again, this is pretty common, right? You see player A goes for it. Players C and D stop player A. Player B is just sitting there, you know, like trying not to smile. They untap. They win. And everybody's expelled all their resources, stopping the other player. And you'll often hear comments like at a CDH table, somebody will be like, don't go for it. Like, don't do it. I will stop you. And then they're going to untap and win, right? That there's even a kind of a very conscious acknowledgement of this play pattern in a lot of games. And so I think that decks that attempt to win after turn three on average can help cultivate this pattern. I think that lucky seeding, right, being just next in turn order after the deck that's farthest ahead on board, or that's, you know, the fastest deck at the table, is great. And I also think just politicking, doing that intelligently, can help immensely. If you are able to represent that you don't have much going on, or if you are able to encourage another student to go for it by representing that, go for it. Like, I got nothing to stop you. That's a great way to position yourself to reap the benefits of the likelihood of two other opponents being able to stop the third.
You know, you in Copenhagen last year, just sitting there with your Rhystic Study, making no facial expressions.
Yep.
Not looking at your card, just immediately putting it down.
Exactly. And that was a classic win after, right? Like, Korvold soaked up all the resources and I was ready to go. And there you go. You know,
also one of the longest turns in history.
I mean, cool though. You got to love it when somebody steals a Mind's Desire and goes for it that way. That's a fun line. And then the fourth win condition, the fourth play pattern that we see a lot, is winning because. This one's probably the most controversial because it's the most frustrating. This is what happens. Let's imagine that player A, you know, they bounce a stacks piece, they cast a wheel, they fizzle, they pass the turn. And surprise, surprise, you know, one of the players shortly thereafter will win. And I think that this is the pattern that you have as an individual player the most power to create, because you can cultivate mistakes that your opponents make. You can encourage them, and not, you know, not being mean or cruel or a bully, but you can encourage them in subtle ways to make mistakes to increase the likelihood that you will win because of an error, because of a misperception that they made, or because of them feeling frustrated and just wanting to take some game actions. Mm-hmm. And really, the simplest way to do this is just guide attention away from you, right? Mm-hmm. As, you know, as we've talked about before, I think talking is the best spell you can cast in a game of Commander, and particularly in a game of CDH, just talk. And by guiding attention away from you, you will make another player feel more pressure, which will probably, in, again, average circumstances, cause them to play worse than they normally would. And you will garner less attention for what you're preparing to do, which, again, mm-hmm. will help the other opponents not assess the situation as accurately as they should. And I think because of the way that decks are constructed in CDH, and because of the kinds of players who wind up playing CDH, the folks who generally want to be pretty interactive, not everybody enjoys that, but I think quite a few players do. I think that winning after and winning because are the patterns that ultimately players should think about cultivating from the very early stages of you know, preparing for an event, thinking about, okay, is this deck a good win after or win because deck? Am I as a player prepared to try to just sandbag, buy my time things appropriately? Or am I going to feel nervous with this deck? Am I going to want to jam the win as fast as I can? You know, how disciplined are my mulligans? Can I mulligan in such a way where I find these hands that are good, but not terrifying? So that mm-hmm. when I'm, you know, playing the first few turns, people don't really worry that much. You know, all these things are skills that somebody, I think, can cultivate to win more often and to think about deck construction and card choices more thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because win because feels like it applies a lot of times, and I feel like there are probably people who listened to our episode last week with Scoots and Shauna, where they can hear Scoots decrying the people who play stacks decks and don't know what they're doing with them, and or, you know, the person who bounces the stacks piece and then you lose because they couldn't win with that stacks piece gone. Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that I would ask, and this is part of why I brought James on, is James has done quite a lot of commentary in your tenure in CEDH. Mm-hmm. And how, in your experience, often do you feel like this always applies? Like, is this just like always something you're seeing?
Yeah. So I would say that this is a really great starting point. Mm-hmm. But I think the reality gets more nuanced. And when I read this thread, my mind kind of went to a thing that I really should write about at some point, but never have. The similarity between CEDH and either soccer or hockey, take your pick. When we think about sports, a lot of Magic players don't, right? They don't think about sports. So, and that's fine. But I do. And I see a lot of commonality between especially these four patterns that Ken has picked out and things that commonly happen in those two sports, especially. Mm-hmm. So the idea of like winning, just going for it, them not having an answer. This is something we might see in games of CEDH where, you know, somebody's got their pieces, their A plus B is in their opening hand, they're jamming it, or they're making somebody have an answer. That's what a lot of soccer teams and hockey teams do. They have players that make direct runs towards the goal and they put a ball in and they go for it, or they take a shot on goal, we got a break, and they go for it. But that really only works successfully very often in sports if you have superior talent. So you have an actual physical edge. What does that talent look like in CEDH? Well, that's your card quality, right? So like Thassa's Oracle Consult, that's our superstar player. That's our...
Alex Ovechkin.
Yeah, well, Ovechkin's not a great example because does one thing really, really, really well.
Well, okay, like, listen, I did like three or four hockey player names. I can't pronounce the rest. You got a hockey player. Yeah. I'm proud I could pronounce that.
That's pretty good.
You got it. Yeah, it's more like, than me. Like a... Matthew Tkachuk or Austin Matthews or Connor McDavid in hockey, or in soccer, it's your Paul Pogba, your Kylian Mbappe, your Messi, your lesser extent Cristiano Ronaldo, but like at one point in his career, Cristiano Ronaldo, right? So you've got that power, but like Ken said, those wins are harder to do because you have to have that raw power. Other decks can get that raw power, but oftentimes it takes assembling multiple pieces. And the piece I see missing from this the most is stacks decks don't necessarily win these ways as often as other decks do. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece where I was like, all right, what do stacks decks do? Do they win directly? And sometimes. Do they win through other people's interaction? I mean, to a certain extent, yes, but largely because they eliminate that interaction through their course of play, right? Yeah. Do they win after other people go off? Oftentimes, no. So like winning through, to continue the sports analogy, would be sort of like just a sustained pressure throughout a game. Yeah. Right. So in hockey and soccer, the reason I think about those two specifically is because they have such a flow that other sports don't necessarily. Mm-hmm. Basketball does, but I don't like basketball as much, so I'm going to ignore it.
personal preference.
But this would be like sustained pressure in the attacking third of the ice or the field. You know, you've got the puck and your opponents behind their blue line for, you know, 3 or 4 minutes straight. It gets goals because they're not ready to defend it. Winning through in CEDH is that sustained pressure. You've got the pieces to answer what's going on. You've got the pieces to maneuver around them because it's not always about answering them. It's about playing around what you know is there. Mm-hmm. Winning through with the sports thing is like a counterattack. They've made an attack. You then counterattack. You stop it and you have the pressure to go quickly the other direction because winning through happens quickly. That's what I've noticed a lot in CEDH games and commentary. If somebody goes for a win attempt and gets stopped, somebody else will almost always immediately also go for a win attempt.
Yeah.
And sometimes they get stopped. But if you don't immediately go for a win attempt, oftentimes you're getting another 2, 3, 4 turn cycles because you don't have that ability to immediately counterattack.
Mm-hmm.
And then the win, because I see this kind of like in hockey, power play, in soccer, set pieces. Your opponent messed up. You get an advantage because of it.
Yep.
Now, obviously in CDH, it's more complicated because you've got 4 players. So there's 3 other people who can occasionally mess up. And let us also state that just because an opponent does a thing that is not beneficial to you, that may lose you the game, does not necessarily mean it was a misplay for them. This is, I think, a common thing that CDH players do, just as an aside, that we probably need to stop. But Stacks decks don't do that either. What do Stacks decks do? Stacks decks break you down over a long period of time.
Stacks decks are like the New England Patriots of CEDH. They're just going to play hard Big Ten football. They're just going to run the football right up between the guards.
Yes. They're going to make you eventually do something. And if you can do something, you can beat a Stacks deck, right? Stacks decks in the metagame project are the lowest performance win percent deck of any major deck type. Now, it's a little bit lower than I'd expect to see, but there are lots of reasons why that's the case. They're hard to play. They're very easy to screw up and cause other people to win because somebody did something else. And they play. Now, I'm going to continue the sports analogy with soccer and hockey here. They play like a team that does a lot of passing to get the perfect shot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They break you down with a lot of little pieces here and there before taking that shot. And sometimes those teams win the game or get a tie in soccer, because that happens a lot, because they don't get to the point where they can actually get that perfect shot, but they break it down enough that like there's a mistake that somebody makes and they can pounce on that one mistake. Mm-hmm. Stacks decks work the same way. I mean, especially WinConless stacks, they win through combat.
Yep.
That's not winning directly. That's not winning through. That's not winning because. That's not winning after. That's I'm just taking it to your face multiple turns in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like this framework and this conception. I think it's got a couple pieces where we want to think about, all right, how do other things fit into this? And I almost envision it like, you know, one of those quadrant charts.
Yeah.
Where we can like draw a line. So like winning through and winning because kind of seem on opposite ends. And then the other axis would be winning directly and winning after. So that you kind of have different decks that fall in different ranges, which then goes back to, all right, how are we building decks? How are we politicking? Because when, again, continuing the sports analogy, when you construct a team as a general manager, you want players who work well together and mesh together and can do certain things. So like Ken said, if you're playing a deck that wins after well, you want cards, your players, that can help you win after. But if you have a deck that's constructed to only do one thing, then you get broken down very easily.
Yeah.
Like if you're just going to jam 20 A plus B combos, you're going to lose more often than you win because people are going to know that's what you're doing and they're going to be prepared to stop you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yeah. Wow. This is the first time that I've considered StackStex to be like the San Antonio Spurs about a decade ago. You know what I mean? Like that's you know, this is what makes sense to me, because, you know, you got to have the Popovich mentality to play WinCon with Stacks. You have to have a peace of mind, an equanimity, calmness, because otherwise it can just seem so frustrating to take losses. But hey, all the fundamentals are there. I'm doing it all right. I'm timing everything expertly, but you know, it's still not enough.
God, this analogy with like sports, I'm just thinking like Russell Westbrook is like probably an outdated win con, if that's the
I love that. Oh my God.
Oh man. We're cornering
Russell Westbrook just out here taking shots, just randomly like getting drive-bys by the Sculpty Boys podcast.
Listen. Yeah. Listen, I've called myself the Colin Cowherd of CEDH, and so I would be doing him injustice if I didn't take a shot at Russell Westbrook.
That's fair.
I also need to get a shot in at Aaron Rodgers at some point.
With all respect to every professional, semi-professional, high school, college athlete ever, you are all able to do things that I cannot do physically.
Correct. Oh yeah.
I'm best humor.
I'm a potato, so I can't talk shit. Yeah. I'm just a little potato, fingerling potato at that. So don't worry about me.
I don't do much anymore, but that's also because I kind of fucked myself up playing football.
That's how it works, it seems. Yeah.
Football will do that to you. Yes.
I played on the line, so that should explain everything.
Yeah.
And I was undersized on the line, so I had no business playing a line player. But I think that's a really interesting way of conceptualizing that. And that like, it really resonates with me, because when you talk about it in that framework, I really think about it. And of course, my mind always goes to football, because football's, you know, like the thing that I know really, really well, that's not magic. And it's interesting because I think of how you can, whichever way you kind of want to attack it. And it is kind of like what you said. There's like the Greg Popovich approach with the Spurs. I know I kind of keep mixing sports, but you have that, or Pop is very similar, you know, Bill Belichick's approach to, we're just going to play very classic football. We're just going to make you, you know, we're going to grind you out. You have to have it. And if you are better than our system, then good for you.
I mean, the term chess match gets used when we talk about coaches facing off each other against each other's systems, right? CDH is not chess. They are different, but you still have that sort of idea of a chess match, right? I am playing a mental game at the same time that I am playing with these physical pieces. Now, obviously, there's no variance in chess and significant. Well, I guess there's who goes first, which, look at that, like CDH.
Yeah, but, right.
But other than that, there's not a whole lot of variance in chess. So. Obviously, it's very different there, but you do still have that mental piece of, how am I making my system align with your system? How am I approaching what you're doing? How am I making adjustments to it? And how am I attempting to counter it with what I am?
Yeah. And I think that this is the, you know, thinking about planning out a game or tailoring a game to one's own understanding of one's preferences, right? What kind of deck do I like to play? What kind of play patterns do I like to pursue? When am I a player who really thrives when I'm going for it first? Am I a player who really likes to take it slow, bide my time, get protection, play safe? Understanding that is, I think, very important, because while there are some great players, right, like Ian, who can win with a ham sandwich and a
you could hand him a roll of duct tape and he'd figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. You could win with one of those rubber chickens and a bent fork.
If we're going to continue with the sports analogy, earlier this week I tweeted, I think Ian is the LeBron James of CEDH.
Yeah.
I'm not biased, but
just a juggernaut, right? Like there are some players like that who can play any kind of deck, stacks, win con with stacks, combo, turbo, mid-range, whatever, and be fine. But I think my suspicion is that a lot of players, maybe I'd say like in an average case, you know what you like, and you know what you're good at more so than other archetypes. Mm-hmm. And so I think understanding one's own system is a great way to, again, tailor the game to your strengths, so that when you begin the game, before you've even seen your first opener, before you've seen your first hand, you already feel like, I am already playing the game on my terms. I'm not mm-hmm. playing the game on the opponent's terms, right?
Yeah.
And of course, variance is hellacious here. And so you're not always going to get to play the game you want. But knowing what that system looks like and mm-hmm. knowing how to cultivate that same pattern as often as possible and find the beauty in that repetition, I think goes a long way to helping people really settle into CDH as a way of playing Magic and as a way of mm-hmm. playing a really complicated, statistically difficult, competitive multiplayer game.
Yeah. So yeah. When you look at those different ways of like, okay, I like to play this way. You know, we kind of can talk about it. I think, you know, you said this in your thread, but you can, you know, play a rogue deck. You can play something mm-hmm. that people aren't familiar with. You can do what you do with Quark and Sakashimna, which is mental stacks. Which yeah. is, I just, this deck is so complicated, you're not going to be able to know what I'm doing. and hilariously enough, like, that is like a real way, like Quark and Sakashimna, players who do really well with it win because generally they're very good at it, and B, nobody knows what's happening. there's a lot of times with Quark and Sakashimna, and like, I don't mean this as a knock on you, but I think this is a very good example of this, is it really is a deck that does a really good job of, if my opponents are savvy, they can stop me.
Yes.
If my opponents aren't, then I'm going to run away with this game. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of those, like, I don't know if I would classify it as win because, but you know, it feels like those sorts of things where it's almost like if I were to continue with the sports analogy that we started, the Sean McVay of like CEDH decks, where Sean McVay has a lot of it's very simple what it's actually doing. And if you know how to defend against it, you can stop it. Yeah. But it's really flashy. It throws a lot of stuff in your face. There's yep. a lot of, you know, movement, there's a lot of coin flipping, and it gets people kind of out of sorts. And yes. I think that's very interesting, like how you can just by what you're playing influence those things. And that's something we've talked about before, where like, you know, there's that politic aspect of like everything you do in a game of CEDH is, or in a game of EDH is politics. What's mm-hmm. what commander you sit down at the table with, what, you know, you're saying a lot with what you sit down with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a piece that Ken included here that I think this flows into really nicely, which is this line from classic Magic article, Who's the Beatdown, which is from Mike Flores, and it's misassignment of role equals game. And I think picking a deck that you know, and both that other people don't know, not to say that these things have to be true at the same time, but a deck you really know well. I mean, if we talk about Ian has done well with a lot of different decks, but almost all of those decks are something he has worked on to develop over time.
Yep.
Right. The Tivit list he used is, I believe he got the inspiration from somewhere, but it's mostly, you know, he worked with it for a while. Winota, he was largely an originator of that deck. Evolution, he worked well with the people who started building that deck, and he's done very well with it over time. And so knowing your deck better helps you figure out your role better.
Hold on, James, we can't call it evolution. We have to frustrate Ian as much as humanly possible. We have to call it Advantage Thrasios. We have to annoy Ian as much as possible.
All right. Sand Black Midrange.
Exactly. Exactly.
A lot of these decks, you know, they have become known quantities, but that was not always the case.
Right.
And when a deck is not a known quantity, it is harder for an opponent to appropriately assess what that deck's role is.
Yep.
And of course, a deck's role at the table changes so often. It changes with, theoretically, every card drawn is an mm-hmm. opportunity for a deck's role to change. Every action taken may change what each role is. And when you have four players in the CEDH game, that becomes exponentially difficult to track over time. So even the best players we see, and we see this in CDH tournaments all the time, and regular tournaments too, like the mental fatigue is a piece where a lot of people don't take it seriously. Like, it gets taken for granted. At the end of Oktoberfest, Brian Koval was spent.
He was a shell of a human.
Spent.
Yeah.
And he played so well in that final game. And part of the reason it's so impressive is, A, how tired that entire final table was. And they all played very well. But he identified what his role was on that blue farm deck from the get-go. He made a couple decisions in that game that we commentated, because Callahan had joined me in the booth for that finals. We commentated on, like, we're not quite sure why he made that decision, but in retrospect, it makes perfect sense with how he just very clearly found his lane and plowed through it and said, this is what I have to do to win this event. And
I think that's a great example, because, like, I think, like, a moment that I think about in that game a lot is very early, it was like turn two, maybe turn three, he Enlightened Tutored for Rhystic Study. And when we saw Enlightened Tutor, I'm like, oh, he just has has Underworld Breach. And no, he was grabbing an Rhystic Study. And that's when when he revealed that, I very distinctly remember being like, oh, we're here for a while. And
well, another play he made was the dress down simply to unlock his commanders. And then the dress down went away and everybody else's commanders are again relocked because somebody else had a Dranith Magistrate on the board. Which, that's another play that if you are locked into, I'm going to be the mid-range deck, I'm going to outvalue everyone else. And you've got Crom and Timna in the command zone that have been locked away since turn two, then that makes perfect sense. But in the high stakes game where we think, oh, Blue Farm's going to go for an Adnaz or a Breach or whatever else, we see the dress down to get rid of the Dranith Magistrate. And we're wondering, all right, is this, you know, is he going to try and punch it through here? But by that point, it was very clear he had established himself. No, he's the guy with the value engine. That's what's going on.
Yep, exactly. And I think, right, thinking about one's deck choice and one's assignment at the table, thinking clearly about that, I think, is a great way to understand when you're going for, right? Because this is, that was, right, if you are tutoring the Rhystic Study, you're not going for that win. You're not going for an early win. You know you are playing a long game, which means that you understand that the longer the game goes, right, the better the player, the longer a game goes, the more likely they are to win. Because they can capitalize on opponents' mistakes and they'll make fewer of them. It's right. It's just a numbers game. Like, and so I think that that is a perfect understanding of what mid-range does, right? Yeah. Mid-range is just, all right, we can play forever. I'm always going to be relevant. I'm always going to be accruing resources. I'm
and
never
going to
feel
the longer you let me hang around, the more likely it is that I win.
It's just like inevitable. That sense of inevitability builds up. And so I think that, while it might be confusing from the CDH perspective of just like, oh, jam it. Like, you know, go for it. You got that tutor. Push it. Nope. He, Brian knew. And again, I think that that's a great way to use that quadrant, James, that you mentioned earlier, right? Think like, okay, what does this deck excel at? Well, you know, Timna Krom, mid-range, that is a great win through and win after and win because deck. It's great at all those. And it can, you know, it's strong at win, but it doesn't need to do that at all, at all. And so if you've got a deck that's strong in three quadrants and has access to great cards and a ton of them, again, if piloted well for a long game, the inevitability is there. But that's not every deck, right? If you sit down with Magda or whatever, you're not gonna play it the same way.
There's another perfect example from another event. That Slicer deck, that did it top four Silicon Dynasty?
Top 16.
Top 16. So that deck, top 16 with this bizarre Transformers commander that lets you just attack a whole bunch. And it lets everybody gets going. And that's a deck that I saw multiple people who had been playing in the event who played against that deck, because it sounds like a couple people took it and one of them top 16. And I don't know who piloted it. That's my bad at this. But playing a list like that requires people to immediately from the get-go. As soon as that commander hits the board, you have to start assessing, all right, what is my role here? Because that slicer needs to be attacking basically the player who is the most likely to be the win. But at the same time, that enhances every other player's opportunities to win through or win after. Because as soon as you eliminate one player, I mean, player removal is significant in CDH.
Yeah.
And because that's an entirely unknown deck, I saw lots of people posting about like, well, we put 18 damage on this person. All right, 21 commander damage kills somebody. 18 damage doesn't get there. So that's a choice where somebody said, all right, this is what's happening. I need to either break that mold because of X or Y or Z or whatever else. Mm-hmm. Or it could be an honest mistake, too. Sometimes you get somebody to 21 damage or 18 damage, and you really just ought to get them to 21. Right? So that's a really interesting deck, specifically in, I think, these tournament EDH decks. Because playing it in a casual pod, I think it would probably work out differently than when there's more on the line at an event. I think there's a number of decks like that in CDH that are kind of on the fringe and have more tournament viability than, say, playing at my LGS viability.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and something there, too, that I think is important is Slicer did a pretty good job of revealing the importance of talking yet again. Mm-hmm. Right. This is a deck that if its three opponents talk and communicate clearly and agree more or less on what they're going to do, the deck gets a lot worse. And so again, that deck kind of assessed from quadrants about when and how it's supposed to win. That's going to get real hard to win through if opponents are communicative, because they can just be like, yeah, you know what's a lot harder to deal in 61 or 21 commander damage? How about 63? Let's just spread it around, right? We're all sticking in this. There's no turbo deck. Let's just spread it around and stay in the game as long as we can. And suddenly that deck gets a lot weaker. In the same way, right? If folks had understood what Magda was up to back in Seattle not too long ago, probably wouldn't have gone 7-0. But again, you just look at it and you go, I don't know. Okay, tutoring, sure.
Yeah. Well, okay. I remember talking to Alana after a game that she had played up at Marquesa. Shout out to the Michigan home. And she was talking about how, you know, there had been an opposition agent on board. Somebody removed it to cast their own tutor, and Magda just won over them. That's what it does. So that's a classic example of misassignment of role. And somebody thought, oh, I'm going to win here, not realizing that Magda was actually just going to not just win through, but win over.
There's
been so many times. There's somebody in our local meta who plays that deck. And every time I sit down at a table with him, I immediately look at the table and I was like, okay, so we just remove the Magda. We don't let it go. And they're like, oh, well, yeah, but we need to get rid of this thing. And I'm like, no. The Magda's going to win the moment you give it a window. Like, the moment you give it an opportunity to win, it's going to. And it's just like, it's not like a, what is it, like Turbo Nos, where Turbo Nos gives you like a window where you can get them and you can really just fuck them up. Magda doesn't have that window. Or, you know what I mean? It's like
the timing, it can fit anywhere.
You have to keep your foot on the gas the entire time when you're playing with Magda, and you cannot let up, because the moment you let off is they just do their thing. And that's what I've noticed with that deck. But it's interesting how decks like that, like Slicer, I know Phoenix has described Slicer as political stacks because it is making your opponents talk to each other and figure out the correct way of playing things. And if they can solve your Rubik's cube of politics, they will probably beat you. But that can be easier said than done. And that's why people like Matt Sperling are picking up Slicer, because it's a deck that they are going to have a huge advantage playing.
In a certain sense, CDH, no matter what four decks are at the table, is always sort of a four-way prisoner's dilemma. And Slicer makes it even more obviously so. It's like, if I do this, if I stab you in the back, what do I gain from it? But what do I lose?
It's a calculation
everybody's got to make very rapidly.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think one of the reasons why I wanted to articulate this thread was to simplify our thinking about CDH a little bit, because it is incredibly complex, right? Like, Magic's Terrain Complete. Like, this is a game that computing power can't play optimally, at least not yet. And that is rare among games. And then you add the statistical variance of a four-player free-for-all, and things get really, really wacky. But at the same time, right, card pool is narrow. One can kind of memorize most of the card pool pretty quickly by playing. And the ways the games end, not that complicated, right? You either win with damage, commander damage, mill, or card that says I win the game on it. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's how you're going to get there. And so I really wanted to make sure that players don't get kind of lost in the sauce. You know what I mean? That we don't just get so kind of mega brained about, like, oh my God, I have to account for X and Y and Z and A and B and C. And I find that the more you play, the more you kind of feel those essential rhythms and just intuitively get a sense of, like, all right, this is this kind of game, or this is that kind of game, or, you know, we're going to be here for a while, or nope, I feel like this is going to end real quick. So I got to, you know, hold up interaction or go for it now. And getting a sense of tempo, I think, helps when you are trying to identify what kind of chess matches are possible. You know what I mean? Like, you look at the board, you look at the chessboard, and you're like, well, you know, these pieces are gone and these pieces are here. I know what's possible here. I've seen it. I've felt it. I've played it. And I want to make sure that players feel that while the game is still very complicated, and CDH games get so weird, by the way. Oh my God. I think it's so funny. It's so funny that, like, you know, folks are like, oh, CDH is, you know, it can be homogenous and it's the same win conditions. I'm like, all you got to do is go to a tournament and last past the cut, and you'll see games get extremely strange. You know, somebody is gilded draking like a vanilla 4/4 or something because they need to block the Crom because they're about to die to Crom damage. But also the meme betrayal could just unlock a piece of removal for the other thing. And it's like, it's not just like, here's Thoracle and the counterspell and I win. Mm-hmm. It is much more dynamic. But again, the core patterns, not that complicated, know? And that getting that sense of rhythm comes back in my mind to the fact that CDH is a game of repetition. The beauty is in the repetition. So thinking about it is like, hey, this is like a dance routine. You know what I mean? We're either salsaing or we're tangoing or we're waltzing, but it's the steps are defined there. You just have to listen, you know, pay attention to the music and pay attention to your dance partners, right? See how they're moving. Because
it's like playing jazz. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's like playing jazz with a jam band where on the fly, you're coming up and figuring out all of these things. You have a baseline rhythm of what you're going with, and then everybody's just kind of fucking around and they take their turn and they fuck around, and then somebody plays off of that thing. And I mean, that's
maybe somebody is playing trumpet so hard that they fall off the stage and tumble to their death, and then the band keeps playing, you know, that happens too. But it's just, you know, it's just like, I think that rhythm is one of the hardest things to communicate clearly. And I think that that's why that Flores article is so brilliant, because tempo and rhythm is not something that is that quantitatively measurable in a multiplayer game of Magic. You get a sense of, okay, we know our kind of average turn the game ends. So you get a sense of tempo in that respect. You can kind of understand how often after you play a deck with a ton of reps, how many hands am I going to see? How many turns am I going to see on average? You know, and I'll plan around that. But the subtler shifts and, okay, wait a minute, this person went from going, you know, they were way behind and then they resolved their dockside and now everybody needs to 3v1 them immediately. And being very receptive to that change of tempo and not just being like, hey, my game plan is do X, right? I'm just going to force it. And if it blows up in my face, it blows up in my face. But being more receptive to changing one's sense of where the game is at and where it could go is so hard to articulate, right? With strategic advice. It's elusive because, again, it's not like we can't boil down super strict principles to be like, oh, just follow these rules of thumb and you won't, you know, step on your partner's toes in the dance or whatever.
Right.
I mean, but I think that's fundamentally the level up moment. right? In CDH, like understanding, all right, this is where the tempo shifts. And it's what, like, look, talking about like 1v1 Magic, it's where players who are very, very good at playing control, like they know, all right, this is where the switch flips and where I am now actually going to win the game because I need to do these aggressive steps. Versus, you know, in CDH, it's the same deal. Like, you have to know, all right, when do I have this opening? Where do I go for it? Who's giving me the space? And it's, I mean, it is like a dance or like an awkward Zoom call at work, you know, where everybody's trying to figure out, all right, when do I say my thing? PO is there. What do I need to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, talking about what's essential to CDH is also just from kind of a PR perspective, right? Kind of nice because you're welcoming in players by saying, look, yeah, there are a lot of cards and lots of things that you might not know intimately immediately, but you play a lot. Games kind of wind up shaking out one of four, maybe five or six ways if we're thinking about win con list stacks, right? Got to figure out a fun thing to fit in the acronym. So as someone playing win con list stacks right now and working on a deck, I'll just say that rarely win. We'll just say rarely win, is it? You know what I mean? But it's kind of nice from a PR perspective because, again, you can make people feel like, all right, this is a game I've already kind of played. You know, I know what commander games, I know how they can go, and I know how multiplayer games can go. I know I've watched some hockey, I've watched some soccer. Like, this isn't, the concepts are not alien, even though there are lots of cards with rules text on them that you got to get used to seeing. But it's still, you know, we're still playing a game, and we're still playing a game that has very similar tempos and rhythms to other games. And it also, I think, demystifies CDH as being some kind of like spectacular, you know, format in which every game is just like shocking or things go so fast, you know, you can't keep up or whatever, and be like, no, it is beauty and repetition, right? It is getting better incrementally by improving on subtle, very subtle skills. And you get to play, you know, some of the fastest guns or some of the fastest guns that are good at slowing down fast guns. That's a weird analogy, but you know, a gun that shoots another gun and makes it slower.
Artillery.
Yeah, exactly. But like, you know, you're still inhabiting the same rhythms.
Right.
And so, you know, don't be afraid to try it out, and don't be afraid to explore those questions of like, well, what am I actually trying to do here? What does this deck want to do? Does it just, is it a turn 2 deck or is it a turn 10 deck? Mm-hmm. And what do I like to do? You know? Yeah.
And I think a big lesson that we can take away from this as well, beyond just winning or anything like that, is how we build decks with things that maybe were more popular in the past that have fallen out of favor. Like, I think there's a lot of win cons that are no longer, you know, premier, but certainly still viable, right? So I think like Food Chain Corvo.
You know, the Derrick Roses of the CEDH world.
Yeah. I mean, all right, I'm going to say this here. I think this is where Alex Ovechkin fits in hockey. Like, the dude does one thing really, really, really well. And like, there's a place for that because he's still doing that one thing really well.
Shane Vale Teferi.
Yeah, exactly. Does he defend well? No, not for shit. Does he, you know, move around the ice well? Absolutely not. The dude's older than I am. Like, he's ancient in hockey terms. However, you put him at the left point on a power play, dude will score. So this, to go back to Magic, thinking about what formerly like premier win cons are still viable that can be used to enhance or break down or attack these different decks that we are seeing in your own local metagame. I mean, no deck is going to be able to answer anything on a global scale. We don't even know what a global scale looks like, really.
Yeah.
We have lots of individualized, localized metagames. So what you see in CEDH might be different than what somebody else sees, and it will still be CEDH, which is weird to say because there's also things that people think are CEDH that are not. But that's an entirely other discussion.
Right.
Thinking about your win cons and how you put that deck together, and kind of goes back to knowing what you're doing, knowing your role, and knowing if your deck has a certain role, what win con that, or card or tech or whatever, that maybe is passe on decks on the database or in tournaments might actually still be incredibly beneficial to you in that deck.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that one thing we can say about silly little Karkashima now is, now that it's gotten a decent track record, is and now that we've gotten a good amount of data about what the deck does and what its play patterns are, is you know, we have learned through experience that it's a great win after deck. Mm-hmm. And that's, and now, only now though, are we making that clear to folks in the, in my primer and in videos and conversations in our Discord server, of being like, yeah, sure, you'll get the turn two, turn three wins sometimes, but they're rare. You're, mm-hmm. you're going for turn five. You know what I mean? Stick around for five turns and you'll get that inevitability. And that's probably where you'll be okay and well poised to win, and, you know, with some backup or something. And, but again, that was only after playing,
right?
You know, and that's why I think paying attention to the old pros who still play the decks like CVT, Chain Veil, Teferi, or who are still playing, you know, I don't know. I don't think First Sliver or Food Chain's that out of fashion, but Food Chain, I feel like I see it less and less. But paying attention to those folks, getting a sense of what they already understand about their own deck is crucial, because you know, you don't, as a brewer, as a player, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Just figure out the pattern and try it out, and you might have a blast. You might be like, you know what? I want to bide my time and win after every single game. I want to just, you know, that, like, that's what I enjoy most. Or, hey, I want to win through. I want to fight like tooth and nail, you know, and just go for it.
That was one of the things I realized, because I spent a little bit of time playing like some Turbo Nas decks last year, and just kind of getting like a feel for, in, you know, trying to like expand my palette, so it were. And my brain doesn't operate this way.
Yeah.
It just is not how I want to be playing Magic either. And so I went back to playing Tarrasius and Timna, and I went back to playing Arden and Silas, and Arden and Crom, and then eventually Arden and Silas. And it felt more natural. My win rate was just, like, arguably better than it was on those Turbo Nas lists. But I mean, like, even when I would play Najeela, like, I was playing like a complete creature combo Najeela deck that was all built around Birthing Pod and things that you can't interact with, and working on a completely different angle than most people were working. Like, I was playing Kiki Jiki in my Najeela deck. Most people don't do that. that's one of the things where I kind of look at that, and I really agree with what you're saying, is, you know, find what vibes with you, and really, you know, it's, you know, I swear to God, we'll eventually end the sports analogy, but it's like, you know, what works in your system. You know, you're kind of the coach of your Magic deck, and what works for you, and what you're looking to do in a game, very much matters. And there's lots of different ways that you can win in Commander. And it's very interesting to see the way people approach things. I hate that Slicer exists. Just need to say that
I love Slice. I love all decks that are like the flavor of the week and that are just work on a silly new axis. But it is funny. Just,
it's the new model, the card, or the fact that it's a transformer. Which part
it's the card. It's the fact that it's a mono. It's the mono red thing that happens at, like, the same time. It feels like every year is there's some new mono red thing, or Godo spikes again, or it's all, so every mono red deck is the same deck. Dude, in
this, like, is his, this hood. Is history, like, of Magic though.
One
of the decks that consistently performs well at the start of every new standard season, red deck wins.
Red deck wins, baby. Yeah.
Because when you don't know what a format's going to look like, it's impossible to play control. It's hard to play mid range, but you know what you can do? Point burn spell at face.
Yeah. Damage. And big creature.
Every mono burn. Red deck in CEDH is just Godo in disguise. There might be,
man, you know that funny joke about, you know, like, every Magic mechanic is kicker? Yeah. I could see a world in which somebody made an argument, and a good one, that every CEDH deck is Godo. I could see it. I could see it, right? Because Godot is okay.
You need access to one thing. I don't know that'll give you that much. but I will grant you, I will at least agree with you that I think at minimum every mono red deck is just a different, it's just Godot in a trench coat.
Honestly, it feels like the Pagliacci joke. But Doctor, I am Godot.
Yeah. Exactly. Yep. I mean, and too, I want to make sure to encourage our listeners too. Like, don't, you know, while it is good and fine, and I think really fun to figure out your lane, find the kind of win condition you want to recreate most often, find the tempo that you like the most, find the deck that plays to your strengths the best in terms of how it operates relative to other decks and their tempos. Do that. But also, you feel free to Jordan it for a while. Retire, go play baseball. You know what I mean? Like, go change it up. Do something different.
Go save the Looney Tunes.
Exactly. I mean, that's the most important thing of all, for
is
sure.
Is that when you go and play traditional casual EDH?
Yeah, for real. Like,
must
you know,
be Bill Murray then, because I've been playing casual a lot recently.
But that will help you. It will really help you stretch your muscles, right? It'll make you just a more well-rounded player. It'll also acquaint you with those patterns that you're going to face across the table often, so that you'll understand from the get-go when they sit down, all right, they want this to be a turn 9 game. No way, I ain't going to let them. You know, I'm going faster than that.
Yeah.
And you might discover that you kind of like it. My only warning is, if you are so foolish like me as to enjoy, brew, and adopt a win conless, i.e. combat damage oriented stacks list without any infinite combos, may God save your soul. it's hard. It's going to be hard, and you're going to lose a lot of games, but it is fun.
Well, that about wraps things up for us here this week. Thank you for tuning into this week's episode. If you liked this episode or any of the other content here on the Mind Sculptors, please make sure to rate the show on whatever podcast platform you are listening on. Or if you're on YouTube, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and tell us down in the comments what your favorite part of today's show was. I also would like to take a moment to thank our top tier patrons, Adam Hamden, David Snavely, Jason Bialik, Matt Boehner, Michael Levine, and Senior Coupon. If you too would like to support the show, you can head on over to patreon.com/themindsculptors or check out the link in the description. Thank you again for joining us, and from all of us here at the Mind Sculptors, I'm Callahan, and we'll see you next time.